This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with the samples. I've been battling allergies for years now. Let me tell you, they've been a real ordeal in my life. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to ClaritinD.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
I've lost weight. You know, wealth is up. Business is going well. More quality time working from home with my family than ever before. So I feel like for us, it's the best of times, but I don't have to look that far from friends or family to be like, oh, there's some real struggle out there. And we try to do what we can and give back in the ways that we feel that's appropriate. But it's a really weird time where you see like a huge cross section of people struggling just to make ends meet. And then you're like, oh, we created more millionaires, billionaires, and more, you know, paper money in the stock market in the last 2 years than ever in the history of America. That feels kind of weird. It's a really precarious time.
What's up, gang? Welcome to The Greatness Machine. I'm your host, Darius Mrshazadeh. I'm so pumped to have you here with me. Now listen, The Greatness Machine, we're about two things. Number one, people who are living their passions. And number two, those who are creating greatness in the world and doing both of these things despite the odds against them. Each episode, we're going to feature interviews with game changers, and business leaders, you know, telling us their origin stories, what made them tick, what got them to where they are now. Why? So it can help you step into your greatness within your life, your business, and your career. Occasionally, you might hear a few solo episodes from myself, moi as I say, as I leverage my 20 years of entrepreneurship as a CEO and founder to help you grow and level up in your journey to scale your life and your business. So come be a fly on the wall, enjoy the conversation, and I'm stoked to have you here with me. Guys, welcome to The Greatness Machine. I'm your host, Darius Mrshazadeh. And boy, do we have a special guest. My main man, Scott Groves, is in the house.
What's up, buddy?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you're like, can we play Temple of the Dog? I'm like, fuck yeah, we can play Temple of the Dog.
Best album of the 90s that never had a follow-up album because it was just like a one-day supergroup.
Yeah, so who was it? It was like
Chris Cornell. Yeah, Soundgarden. And then it was Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam. Yeah. Album almost didn't get released because Eddie Vedder became a super big deal right after they recorded that. And there was all kinds of arguments over royalties. And then it had a couple of the guys from Mother Love Bone because the lead, which kind of became Pearl Jam, because the lead singer of that band had died. So they made that whole album just as a tribute album. And it's like the best representation of grunge from the 90s in a single album and never to be followed up on. Caught lightning in a bottle, just like this podcast.
Exactly. Exactly. This is like today's version of Temple of the Dog.
There we go.
So, guys, for those of you guys that are new to the show, we're about two things. People are living their passions. The Greatness Machine is about people are living their passions, and those are creating greatness in the world. My main man, Scott, and Temple of the Dog are another short of passion or greatness. So, first of all, I just want to, do you mind if I give a little bit of our origin story?
Go for it.
I met Scott through my book launch last year. And so we have some mutual friends. Amber Vilhauer and Isaac Stegman introduced me to Scott to actually promote my book to his coaching group and to his network. And instantly we became fast friends. Like, and then it turns out that another one of my friends who they introduced me to, John Vroman, he's in Front Row Dads. And so we ended up hanging out at the Front Row Dads retreat where I presented the book. And so anyway, Scott and I have we've been running around in circles, and then we're on Facebook a lot, and I see him posting stuff, and we're kind of like challenging each other because we're like a Venn diagram of political beliefs. Like there's like definitely a center where we're like, fuck yeah, you're right, and then the other stuff we're like, I don't know if I agree with you, but I respect what you have to say.
Yeah, so, which is rare in America these days.
If anyone wants to know how to cure the ills of America, just look to Scott Groves and Darius Machado's day.
There you go.
The way we interact is definitely the way that everyone else needs to take notice. But yeah, so then it turns out we both in the come from the mortgage space. You're with Movement Mortgage. I ran the money source. So we got all this overlap. But the thing that I like most about Scott that he doesn't know, most of our relationship, we met in person once at the Front Row Dads retreat, but we haven't spent that much time together in person, mostly virtually online, is he posts, like, we're the same age, right? You're 43?
Yeah.
We're the exact same age. So half the shit he posts is like literally like an arrow to my soul from a pop culture perspective. And I swear to God, we were doing the same shit. We both grew up in like right outside LA. He grew up in Valencia. Is that right?
Yeah. Palmdale, Lancaster area, Glendale, all over the place. We both wrestled.
Oh yeah. That's right. I forgot that you wrestled. So there's all this overlap, but he's always posting this shit where he's like, oh, I love the Rocky movies. And I'm like, I fucking love the Rocky movies. He's like Karate Kid. It's like every single thing. I'm like, dude, I swear to God, we were doing the same thing at the same time, like 100 miles apart or 50 miles apart from each other growing up. So here we are, man.
Yeah, dude. Happy to be here. And, it's funny because it actually shows the beauty of what Facebook is meant to be. It's like you and I couldn't have had more opposite side origin stories, you know, Iran to Southern California. And then somehow through this shared experience on social media, we realize we're like kindred souls and we can have great political conversations and we have business conversations and we can become friends. And we've got a decade and a half of shit in common from when we were both growing up in Southern California. Like, that's the beauty that I think all of us are forgetting about on social media, because everybody focuses on the negativity. But like, you and I wouldn't be close friends if it wasn't for Facebook. So I hate all the negativity because you and I are buddies. That's worth the trade-off.
Yeah, no, I'll take it. I think what ends up happening is, have I ever told you about the story of when I got on Facebook, like this one goal that I had?
No.
I'm going to tell you a story. So I'm going to talk about Scott and his background in a second, but I want to tell the story because it's a funny story. So I'm always an early adopter. I'm early to everything. I moved to Austin in 17. I have started looking to move here in 13. I was looking at houses at 11. I moved to San Francisco in 2001. I mean, I was on Friendster when that was a thing. I was like one of the first people I knew. Social media, I was always first, right? And so I was on Friendster, then MySpace. And then I was hearing about all these college kids, because my sister was in college at the time, who were on this app platform called Facebook. This is like 05, I hear about this. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And so by 06, I'm like, I'm going to go try to sign up for that. But you couldn't even sign up unless you had a .edu in right. your like email. So I went to UC Santa Barbara. So I go to my alumni association page. I sign up and they give you an email address as an alumni.
Nice. And
so I use my alumni association at UCSB, because back then a normal person could not get on Facebook unless you had a .edu. Right. And I get my login to Facebook through UC Santa Barbara Alumni Association. I get on there and nobody I know is on it except college kids. And I was like, well, fuck, this isn't doing shit for me. You know, because like, yeah, I know some people in college, but I'm like 28 years old at the time. Like, I don't know that many people.
Creeper.
Dude, I'm such a creep. since I'm early, a lot of people start joining when I join. And so, and I had a newborn son in 2009. This is about 2 years later. So at that point, it was mainstream. Everyone's joining like in droves, right? This is when Facebook got really was hot. And so I was like, oh man, all these people are showing up every day. I'm like, you're going to laugh when I say what I'm about to say. I said, I'm going to go friend every single person I've ever known in my whole life. I went to like 3 different elementary schools. I went back to like kindergarten, preschool, and I have like an elephant memory. I can remember everyone's names. So, dude, these are people I hadn't seen since I was in first grade. I'm like friending them. And I said, I want to see how many people I can actually connect with who I know. And I ran out at 1,500. I had known these are 1,500 people I actually knew at one point in my life. But then I realized something. I didn't know any of them. I knew very few of them, right?
Right.
I had known them when we were like 7 and we were like beating the shit out of each other on the playground. But like, I quit being their friend in third grade and then we went out and like did our own things. And now here I am at 30 years old friending everybody. Dude, I had the most fucked up face. This is before the algorithm was what is now, where like smart or and censoring. And so dude, before I knew it, I was like, oh my God, I didn't know those were your political beliefs. I have to hear what you ate for fucking dinner last night, dude. And then I went to, and then I was like, okay, I got to untangle this mess. I'm going to go and unfriend all these people. Dude, Facebook makes it nearly fucking impossible. It's like five clicks for an unfriend.
It's miserable. It takes hours.
So I did like 100 and I was, it took me like 4 hours and I was like, oh, I can't do this. I was just, I quit. I tapped out.
You're like, can I hire an executive assistant or a virtual assistant in the Philippines to unfriend all my fake friends?
So then Instagram came out and that was new. And I was one of the first people I knew on Instagram, like in 2010 and or 11. And I was like, oh, I'm doing this one right. If you're friends with me on Facebook and you're not friends with me on Instagram, I'm not your friend. Dude, anyway, so I told you guys how we met Scott, but do you mind if I give your formal bio? I just hijacked this talk about you and about me.
Totally fine.
Guys, so Scott, with almost 20 years under his belt, Scott Gross has received multiple awards for his exceptional service, particularly in loan production. He is a master at Movement Mortgage, building an amazing business over there. Came from New American Funding, Washington Mutual, just has done tons of stuff in the mortgage space. We're going to be talking about his book, Lead Generate, 61 Days to Double Your Pay, as well as his amazing podcast that I go on and say crazy shit on called On the Edge Podcast. So anything else, it meant something because you're doing a ton of fun, cool stuff. So, man, let's start from day one, man. I know you were in the military and then you got into mortgage, but like take us all the way back to like 78.
So yeah. So 78. Actually, I turned 43 here in 2 months. So 79, born to two parents that are great people, but I was born like literally out of high school. They graduated, I think, in June of 77 or 78. And then I was born March of 79. So when you asked, I'm actually only 42. So you're behind you. But crazy. Just grew up in Southern California, like typical kind of middle class family, you know, parents worked really hard. I screwed around a lot in high school. Thankfully, I didn't discover drugs or I would have been a real mess. Oh. But between wrestling, surfing, girls, I almost didn't graduate high school. I had straight A's, but I had 57 absences out of like 200 and something, 220 school days. So my mom had to go petition the school to let me graduate because they had this thing like, even if you had straight A's, if you had more than 50 absences, you weren't supposed to graduate. So anyway, not exactly the best resume to get into college. So like the end of 11th grade, beginning of 12th grade, some army recruiters like trolling around. It turned out if I took the ASVAB test, I would go sit next to Danielle Kumas, who I had a crush on. And we were like next to each other alphabetically, Groves and Kumas, in like the class where we would take the ASVAB test, which is the military entrance test. I did really well. The recruiter was hounding me. So Danielle, if you're watching, you're the reason I ended up in the military for 3 years. Did 97 to 2000 because they had this cool thing where if you sign up your senior year, you only had to do 3 years instead of 4 years. And the crazy story is like, I was an infantry guy. I was pretty good in the military. I was supposed to go, this is the weirdest chain of events, Darius. I was supposed to go to Special Forces Selection Committee, which I think I would have made it through because the two guys I was training with, they both made it. And I had passed all the prelims and done the swim in my, you know, backpack. And I had done the 12-mile road march and all this stuff. And right before we're supposed to ship out for the 30 days, they're like, oh, hey, Groves, you have less than 6 months on your contract. You have to re-enlist if we're going to spend the money to send you to Special Forces Selection. And I was like, well, if I fall and like twist my ankle, like I don't want to get stuck here at Fort Riley, Kansas, in the middle of shithole Kansas for another 4 years. So that kind of made me angry. And then I got in a fight with the recruiting sergeant. So then I got out of the military. And what's nuts is I ETS'd end term service on September 11th, 2000. And Special Forces training is about a year. So had I made it, and I believe I would have made it through the 30-day selection process, I literally would have been getting out of Green Beret school around September 11th, 2001. And the trajectory of my life would have been much, much different. But as it is, I got pissed off at the retention sergeant at Fort Riley, Kansas. I got out of the military, fell into banking like everybody else that falls into mortgage, had no intention of doing mortgages. I was working as a teller, fell into mortgage, rode that wave up to 2008, just like you and everybody else. And then in 2009, I think I made $18,000 and slept on my friend's couch to try to not go bankrupt. Had like a series of fortunate events where I got kind of in-house relationship at a real estate office, started to rebound, like doubled my business every year from, you know, 2010 to 2015, did $100 million in production, That turned into a bunch of phone calls from people saying, hey, what are you doing? That turned into a book. That turned into a coaching program. So now I run a coaching program for loan officers. I still do loans with our amazing team. Actually, my team does the loans mostly. But it's crazy, man. The older I get, the more I realize like variety is my highest value. And yeah. So I'm like a $100 million producer, could be a $200 million producer maybe. But I love the coaching business. I love writing books. I love doing podcasts. And the podcast is super not safe for work. If any of my realtors listen to it, they'll probably never want to work with me again. We talk a lot about guns and libertarian topics and the intersection of evil politics and economics and whatnot. So I'm just like, I'm like a basket case, dude. I have successful ADHD, BDA, DA, whatever the newest diagnosis
GZ,
is.
GZ.
ADH, BDC, I don't know whatever it's called now. I'm that guy, but I've just found a way to funnel it and surround myself with good people and have some pretty successful careers. So I'm happy, man. I'm happy.
Yeah. So I was thinking about that. I'm like, I think we do have that in common. Pretentious fuckers call themselves polymaths. Polymath, is that what it is? When you have like, you know what I'm talking about? Have you heard of this
term? No clue.
Yeah. I think you and I are both a polymath. Not polygamy.
Not polygamous, but yeah.
Polymath? Is that what it is? Polymath? Oh, damn it.
I don't know.
Yeah, polymath.
Oh, okay.
If you're a pretentious fuck, you can call yourself this. It's a person of wide-ranging knowledge or learning.
Ooh, there we go.
So people that have a ton of interest, they'll call themselves, I'm a polymath. I think I am one just because I do really have a lot of interest in a lot of different areas. And in business, it kind of fucks you a little bit because you're like, why aren't you focused for Shaw's Day? And I'm like, because there's all this other shit that's interesting. Look, man, like it's like, and some people are so good at it. They're like, just grind. They're like, all I do is this one thing and I'm better than it than anyone else in the world. And I'm like, dude, more power to you, brother. But I get bored. You know, I'm like, yeah, but I want to go try something else too and go get good at that and then go try something else, you know?
Dude, so, that totally describes me. Like even my hobbies, you know, I've been really good at boxing at like an amateur level for a certain time in my life. And then I was like 5-0 in like the old man amateur boxing circuit. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I should go try jiu-jitsu. And then it's like for a while, every vacation was scuba diving. I became a dive master, like whatever. And then I was like, all right, cool. I've seen a whole lot of fish. I haven't scuba dove in like 12 years, which is kind of weird because my personal email is scubagroves@gmail.com. So it's like, well, that was a passion when I signed up, but I haven't scuba dove in like 10 years, 12 years.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. One day I'm going to win the lotto and then I can just sit around writing random books on different topics that I'm not an expert at, but hopefully have like enough entertainment value that people will read them.
Yeah. But at least you could be an authority on them because you'll be an author. So
yes,
like, exactly. I don't really know shit about this, but I am an authority, which is good enough for me. So let me ask you a question. So dude, you joined the military right before 9/11. And so it's funny, back then, like that was like probably the longest like time where there was like peacetime in America. So I had a bunch of buddies that were in the military in the 90s. It was like, it was awesome. I just go and I get to travel all over the world. And then I get out and they pay for my college. And that was like the norm, right? And then 9/11 happened. So I didn't realize that they did a 3-year program then. They allowed you, it was probably because there was like, nobody really like thought too much about the military back then. It was just like,
no, not at all. And you know what's crazy is like just the convergence of events, like, because I only signed up for 3 years instead of 4, and it was like this, you know, high school transition program, they didn't allow me to go out of country. So there was no chance I was going to get stationed in Germany because, frankly, the Army had done the cost benefit analysis. They didn't want to pay for the plane ticket to Germany. So I get stuck in shitty Fort Riley, Kansas. Because I only signed up for 3 years, they wouldn't send me to airborne school. So all these things that would have been like cool military experiences would have required me to stay in for 4 years, which would have meant that like I would have been in for 9/11 and my life would have taken a massively different trajectory. Maybe better, maybe worse. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe I'm deformed. I don't know. And it's weird because I've got some weird like it's not survivor guilt because luckily no one I was super close with died in the war. But there is this weird thing where it's like, hey, I was a really good soldier. I took up resources to get trained. I was like in a leadership position by the time I left the military. And like, I almost feel guilty that I wasn't in longer to like serve in a combat arena because I was an infantry guy. And I'm like, maybe I would have kept some guys alive. Maybe like I would have like made my mark on society in a different, better way than just putting people in debt for 30 years. So it's this weird thing that screws with my mind when people even say like Happy Veterans Day or thank you for your service. I'm like, yeah, I was in the military and I signed up voluntarily, but I wasn't that guy. Like, I didn't go do 4 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan like so many of my friends have. And some of them are a little in the brain because, like, they saw some shit that you can't unsee. And I'm like, yeah, I signed up. But basically what I did was I swept a motor pool in Fort Riley, Kansas, and got drunk every night for 3 years. So,
yeah, you
know, but it's weird.
Yeah, yeah, no, I hear you on that. But it's like, but you also signed up with the risk of not being what you did, right?
Yeah,
so
that's true.
So I mean, like, I don't think anyone joins the military with the hopes of like never seeing combat. I do think a lot of people are like, yeah, I'm willing, hopefully there is no combat, but I'm willing to go and die for my country, because you're putting yourself in that position when you sign that contract, right? But it's like, hey, look, like, it didn't happen, so you did your part. Like it's not your job to go create wars. Like, leave that to the fat cat politicians.
Hey.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. In the world of successful partnerships, names like Procter & Gamble, Ben & Jerry, and supply and demand echo through business history. But when it comes to growing your business, who are the perfect partners? That's you and Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. We're talking from launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to did we hit $1 million order stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Picture this, a time when my business was facing a tough hurdle and I wasn't sure how to break through. But then came the breakthrough moment, a game changer that took my business to the next level. You know, what I absolutely adore about Shopify is its unparalleled ability to adapt and grow with your ambitions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 75 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Darius, all lowercase. That's D-A-R-I-U-S. Go to shopify.com/Darius now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/Darius. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with the samples. Hey there, friends. It's Darius Mashazda here, and I have a little confession to make. You see, I've been battling allergies for years now, and let me tell you, they've been a real ordeal in my life. Allergies have been my constant companion. They stop me from fully enjoying the little things in life, canceling plans with friends because of sudden allergy attack, to missing out on an outdoor activity because of sneezing fits. Allergies have been a real nuisance. Luckily, for those of us who live with symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing and a runny nose, itchy watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been a Claritin D user for many, many years now, and let me tell you, it's made a world of difference. Since I started using Claritin D, my symptoms have improved dramatically. Now I can breathe easier, enjoy outdoor activities without worrying about sneezing fits, and truly live my life without being held back by allergies. Ready to live as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter now. You don't even need a prescription. Go to ClaritinD.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear, use as directed. When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. When I needed to expand my team, I wanted more than just resumes. I wanted quality professionals who were the perfect fit for our culture and goals. And LinkedIn Jobs delivered just that. LinkedIn Jobs isn't just another job board. LinkedIn Jobs has a vast network of more than 1 billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you can't find anywhere else. LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive. Hiring is easy when you have that many quality candidates. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get qualified candidate within 24 hours. They understand the challenges small businesses face, which is why they're constantly innovating to make the hiring process easier. And just recently, LinkedIn launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions in a snap. Trust me, I've used it. It's like having a personal assistant to guide you through the process, making it quicker and more efficient than ever before. And let me tell you, it made all the difference. With LinkedIn's help, I've been able to attract top talent and build a team that's truly exceptional. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/greatness. That's linkedin.com/greatness to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Funny story, being from Southern California. Do you want to know how boring Fort Riley, Kansas was, like middle of America?
I mean, I can only imagine.
It was so boring that, as you said, you know, like basically end of the Gulf War until September 11th, very peaceful time. There wasn't a whole lot going on. But we had a small mission contingent of engineers. I was an engineering guy. Engineers that had gone to Bosnia and, you know, Kosovo and whatnot to clear landmines. They were part of that, like, Princess Diana clear the landmines for the kids UN mission. Mm-hmm. I was so fucking bored in Kansas that I volunteered to go clear landmines in Bosnia. And they were like, what? And I'm like, yeah, can't you just reclassify me as an engineer? Like, I've taken a bunch of the, you know, co-engineer infantry training. Like, I'll go to Bosnia to clear landmines. That sounds amazing. Sounds better than getting drunk in Fort Riley, Kansas, like Junction City every night. And they wouldn't let me go. So that's how boring the Army was in 1998 in Kansas. I volunteered to go clear landmine.
That is kind of insanity. you know, I'm bored. Can we go do an old clearing of the Viet Cong while we're at it?
Yeah, you know? It didn't really work out.
So you got back and 2000, I guess you get back and you get a job in banking and then you get turned on to the wonderful world of mortgage. So tell us about that. How did you get in the mortgage industry?
Yeah. So funny story, man. A good friend of mine, Jessica Malin, who we're still super close. We were tight in junior high and high school. She was like an assistant bank manager at Washington Mutual. And she was like, hey, man, we have this program where if you're a full-time college student, you only have to work 20 hours a week at Washington Mutual and you get full benefits, medical and whatnot. And I grew up my mom being part of a union working for Thrifties and Rite Aids where she was like habitually underpaid, but she's like, I have great benefits for the family. I have great benefits. So in my mind, getting out of the Army, like no more free healthcare. I was like, oh God, I got to have benefits. I got to have benefits. So I go start as a teller at Washington Mutual. And 30 days later, Jessica pulls me aside and she's like, hey man, you're like out of balance all the time on your cash drawer. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm clearly not stealing the money. I'm out of balance like 7 cents, 8 cents, $1.50. Like I'm not stealing the money. I'm just going so fast. I make mistakes. And she's like, yeah, this is a bank. There is no such thing as like making mistakes. She's like, so we're going to have to either like let you go or you're really good talking to clients. Do you want to go into like the personal banking side and learn how to do like loans and new accounts and home equity line of credits? And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, are you offering me like to either get promoted or get fired? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll take the promotion. So I took the promotion like August or November of 2000. And then started doing second mortgages and then first mortgages and rode that wave up. And you know what's crazy working in the bank? Because you came from kind of like the broker and the wholesale side. Back in the day, if you were doing loans in the branch level, I thought making like $100,000 was all the money in the world. I was like, because I was used to the Army making like $18,000 a year. So making $100,000 in 2005, I had no idea there was brokers making like millions of bucks who were then selling the garbage loans to Washington Mutual that ended up taking us down. And I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't get the money and my company went away. Like, so I screwed up everything from 2000 to 2009-ish. And then luckily found a way to rebound. Luckily I was young, no kids, not a ton of responsibility. I could sleep on the couch, but yeah, that was Washington Mutual. There's actually a great book called The Forgotten Bank, all about the rise and fall of Washington Mutual, the largest bank failure in the history of the world. Phenomenal, phenomenal story that like breaks it all down. And then it was just, you know, rebound and recover and lick your wounds and try to rebuild.
It's funny. It's like, I don't know if I did broker. Well, through Long Beach, I did Long Beach Mortgage, which was which was the trash can for WaMu. But no, listen, WaMu, like they made their bed, man. Like it takes two to tango. You can't broker alone. You can't broker alone to somebody that doesn't want it. You know?
Sure.
So yeah, it's funny, man. I dealt with it was interesting as I was dealing with after the fact. I dealt with the side effects of brokering loans to them because they came back and sued all the brokers afterwards. not the bank necessarily, but the borrowers did. They were suing the brokers and the lenders. So yeah, you guys, so when you left WaMu, what year did you leave them? They became-
So I left them right before they collapsed, and I went out, tried to do my own thing, bounced around a couple companies, and then dumb luck, like I was massively in debt, Darius. Like I think when everything was said and done, the cars, the credit cards, the upside down houses, I think I was almost $1 million in debt. So wow. I racked up like $1 million in negative equity because I was buying houses. I had a condo in Vegas that we bought for $360,000, and a year later it was worth $80,000. So I basically racked up all this bad debt in my 20s, should have declared bankruptcy and just had a fresh start, but I was like too proud about it. So then I spent effectively all my 30s paying off this debt. I got a really great opportunity, kind of a fringe friend, to tell you the truth, was getting married in Belize. And I think like the market was melting down so much, they had a lot of cancellations. So I got an invite and I'm like, well, screw it. This whole thing's gone to hell. I'm going to take my last couple $1,000, go on this vacation to Belize, go to this wedding. It'll be my last like swan song. Maybe I'll come back and declare bankruptcy and then go get a like middle management job at IKEA where my dad's friend was working. And when I was down there, the groom, I knew the bride. When I was down there, the groom was like an assistant manager at a Prudential real estate office. And then the manager was this guy named Kirk Giroux, who I will always forever be blessed and thankful for. On the flight back, he's like, hey man, you seem like a pretty smart dude. Like this mortgage thing is going to hell in a handbasket. But if you come be the in-house lender at our real estate office, you know, somebody will always have to buy a house. You know, somebody, even in the depths of the Great Depression, somebody was investing in real estate. Somebody had enough money and income to buy a house. Somebody's getting divorced, married, whatever. So he gave me a shot and he really had to fight for me to come get this position because I was coming from the bank where I had never sourced my own purchase loan. And I sat in that real estate office for 3 years. And I'm not kidding. Monday through Sunday, first person in the office, last person to leave. I knew everybody's gossip. I knew who was a night owl and was doing this part-time. I knew who was like treating like a business. I knew who was crazy and was never going to close a deal. And I just talked to every single realtor there every single day for 3 years and then had them introduce me to every other realtor on the spot. And that actually, that's what ended up leading to the book on lead generation. Cause I was like, dude, I have nothing and I have nothing to lose and I'm going to go bankrupt. If I don't spend a couple hours a day, every single day, lead generating and building relationships, I'm not going to make it. And so then, you know, then I made like 50,000, then 100,000, then 200, then 400, then 800. And like income just doubled every year from 2009-ish to 2015-ish. And then I kind of found a nice equilibrium where I'm happy with the production. It's kind of stuck around 100 million for like 5 years. But that 5 years was just, it saved my life. Like lead generation really saved my life. I think myself and many other people in the mortgage industry, you know, at one point were thinking about legitimately checking out in the most egregious way. And, you know, it was brutal to like lose everything. I don't know if you remember, but it's like you'd be out with friends or at a cocktail party, which I couldn't afford. So I'd be leeching onto somebody else's cocktail party. And they'd be like, oh, what do you do? And I'd be like, oh, I do mortgages. And you would get this, ooh, that. Oh,
do I remember that? Jesus, you're fucking kidding me.
Yeah, dude, it's like crashed the world economy. And they're like, ooh, you're one of those guys, huh?
Yeah, dude. Oh. First of all, I stopped saying I did mortgages. I told them I did real estate finance.
Oh, so, good job.
Do I remember? Oh, dude, brother. I'm going to be doing a podcast. I made a list of podcast solos I'm going to do. And one is about the time that I got fucking Channel 7 News, Eye on Your Side reporter in my office over some direct mail I sent that was like, nice. I made a mistake on it. It was like an honest mistake. So not only did I have like the embarrassment of being in a mortgage, when people Googled my fucking name, they would see the Channel 7 News like breaking into my office with a fucking camera crew.
Oh, that's the worst.
Yeah, it was not cool because it was really an honest mistake. It was like literally like the worst possible thing that could happen when you screw up.
Yeah.
You know? And it was like an honest, like I wasn't trying to do anything wrong mistake that just like came out wrong. Right. Like, and so I had that on top of it where people were like, ooh, you do mortgage. People would look at you like you're fucking Satan.
Totally.
And I was like, hey, assholes, no one made you take fucking stated income loans. You chose to take those loans.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and you know what's crazy about the whole thing, which really is like kind of the post-mortem on this whole thing is like all these financial institutions and Wall Street and Bear Stearns, they had all of these algorithms and all this crazy, you know, extrapolation of debt based off of the fact that somewhere around 1% of Americans might default at any time on their mortgages. And yeah, we got to a point where like 8 or 9% of people defaulted on their mortgages, which wrecked the national and almost the world economy. But that means 91% of people were still paying their mortgage on time. Like, I know a lot of people that took those liar loans or the stated income loans or whatever, and they had to use them because husband was in college and they were piecing together all these income sources that they can improve. And they built great wealth through the 2000s through real estate because they were able to buy houses on these stated income loans or whatnot. And I don't think we're going to ever go back to that. But I think it's important to remind people that, like, yeah, everything was a shit show. There was blood in the streets when it comes to real estate, and 90% of people were still paying their mortgage on time. It's just, you know, the financial institutions didn't have any, you know, room for error, which, yeah, I get it. Like, my financial portfolio can't be like 10x'd gone the wrong way without me taking a big hit too. But 90% of people still paid on time and had great wealth accumulation through real estate. And God forbid, anybody who accidentally let it all go, they screwed up, man, because now 10 years later, property values are worth even more. So there's a silver lining.
Yeah, there's a moral hazard around this because when people, you know, first of all, I was on the receiving end because I was a broker and a lender during that time. I spent 2007 to 2011 getting fucking sued by everybody. So my story is like, I'm on the receiving end of borrowers. I had a borrower, it's funny enough, that she, I mean, we're talking mortgage, but this is for you listeners out there that want to, like, you know, just check yourself before you wreck yourself, right? Like, people, like, when you sign a contract, know you're fucking signing, right? I had a borrower that started a class action lawsuit against my company. And I was like, my company, I was out of business at this point, right? Like I didn't go up, like, down the way you did, because I did actually do well financially. And then I lived off that for 5 years because I didn't make any money for 5 years. It was the worst, like, 5 years of my life. Right? Like, to work, to wake up in the morning, go to work and cut checks and not take a paycheck for 5 fucking years, 1800 days. Yeah. There's a way better option. Go get a job. Right. But I chose to stick it out, which it worked out for me in the long run, you know, just like it would have worked out for anybody who held on to their homes for that time frame. But I had a borrower took a pick-a-pay loan from WaMu, flipped into a pick-a-pay loan from World Saving. Those are the loans that had the negative interest rates, or, yeah, or 1% interest rate, and you negatively amortize. And she ends up suing me, and we go to the trial, and I show my lawyer. I said, dude, she's been in 5 pick-a-pay loans. I was just the asshole that did the 5th one, you know? So this is a person, it wasn't like she went from a, like, super safe loan to, like, this, like, exotic loan. This is a person that had been living off their equity for 10 years.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then they didn't want to take responsibility for themselves. So I feel like right now the world's coming to this, like, this point where people, you know, some people do want to take responsibility for their actions, but a lot of people, we live in a world of moral hazard, right? Where the government allows for people to not take responsibility for their actions. And yeah, there was definitely victims during that time frame. Don't get me wrong. Like, there were people that got put into loans that they were, like, not smart enough to, like, realize they were being put into. And there was LOs that, and loan officers and mortgage companies that made money off of it. But what ended up happening afterwards, to your point, was you were embarrassed to tell people you're in the mortgage industry.
Yeah.
Because, oh, you caused this problem. And I go, hey, asshole, it takes two to tango. Like, no one can put you into a loan unless you sign on the paper, dotted line yourself.
Right.
So, yeah, they maybe didn't explain it well enough. And there was probably a lot of that went on. But you have a responsibility to know what you're signing, right? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think you're hitting at the underpinning of a lot of our current political and social turmoil, that people aren't really talking about the underlying disease. And I think personally, and if you can't tell by my gun shirt and the On the Edge podcast hat, I'm pretty much a hardcore libertarian, like First Amendment and Second Amendment absolutist. But something that's happening is, like, there's this slow erosion of the importance of contract law in America. So whether it's excusing the borrower who signed the mortgage contract, who didn't know what they were signing, and that contract's no longer valid, or the big push right now to cancel student loan debt. Oh, because this poor 18-year-old didn't know that $100,000 at 4% interest was going to take 20 years to pay back. Well, if they didn't know that, then shame on the educational institute. It's not the contract's fault. It's not the student lender's fault. Same thing with like we saw through the moratorium, right? The pandemic. It was like, oh yeah, well, those contracts where renters have to pay their landlords, city of Los Angeles, you know, county of Los Angeles, state of California, the federal government, we're just going to negate those. Like renters don't have to pay their rent, you know, because we're going through some tough times right now. And this idea of whether it's a government entity or kind of just the like social zeitgeist, just saying that contracts are no longer valid. Yeah. You can't have a functioning society if contracts aren't valid. Like if they're not binding, then it might as well just be anarchy, which, you know, maybe I'm interested in personally, but I don't think it's good. No, you're not. I don't think it's good for society. Like I think it's real bad for business and economics. And, you know, I think like this underlying tone of, well, we can decide which contracts are good contracts and bad contracts and what debts are good debts and bad debts. I think that sets a really, really bad societal precedent because then, you know, you can't, would you want to be a landlord right now in Austin, Texas? Would you want to own a restaurant in Los Angeles, California? Like what are the chances that you can run a profitable business and kind of grow the overall economy if you can't trust the foundation of like the contracts that this shit is written on? It's just, I think it's a real problem.
Hey gang, Darius Mashaza here. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. So listen, I know we have a lot of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and business owners out there that listen to the show. And right now, if you're one of those folks and you're doing, let's call it a bare minimum of seven figures and above in your business, then what I'd like to do is give you an offer right now. How would you like to get your hands on the frameworks that I actually used to scale my last company, which started off as a small little seven-figure company to over $100 million in annual revenue? And I did it in less than 2 years, and I did it without costly growing pains, without the headaches that you usually experience when you are scaling your business. So if you're one of those folks and you're trying to grow your company, but you're finding yourself stuck in that day-to-day, if you're one of the listeners and you're getting grinded, this is your respite from getting grinded on in your business, you're listening to our show, and you're dealing with the breakdowns, you're dealing with inefficiencies, and you know, you've got that firefighter suit on and all the problems lining on your desk, and you're not doing the work you're supposed to be doing, which is working on the business instead of in it, then what I'm about to talk to you about for the next, call it 60 seconds, this is precisely for you. Real quickly, though, if you don't already know this about me, prior to starting the Greatness Machine, I spent 20 years of my life as a founder and CEO of real-world companies, and during that time, I actually grew my companies to over $1.2 billion with a B in bootstrap revenue. In fact, we scaled my last company from 30 to 1,000 employees, and we did it in just 36 months, and we did it all by using a three-step framework that I call my scale map method. So that of course brings us to the purpose of this here mid-roll ad. Yes, this is what the podcast producers call these things. Recently, I created a 30-minute training, and what it does is it walks you step-by-step through all of my scale map method frameworks. And you can watch it right now for free when you go to dariusscale.com. That's my first name, Darius, scale, S-C-A-L-E.com. And what these frameworks do is they fix, they simplify, and they streamline every single aspect of your business, and they do it without the need for complicated scaling systems that are typically way too difficult and way too time consuming for a busy CEO like you and from like myself was to implement. So if you want a simple and you want a proven path to remove yourself from the day-to-day operations, just like I did, so that you can do what you're supposed to be doing, which is leading your company to record growth without the headaches and without the growing pains, go to dariusscale.com. That's www.dariusscale.com. Watch the short video, and I'll see you guys on the inside. Now, back to the show.
Regardless of your feelings on whether the government should print money or not, I agree. And I said this when this happened during COVID, right? I said, whoa, wait a second. So the government can just say you can't pay your mortgage? Like the government can just say that you don't have to pay rent? And I said, okay, what if it's privately owned business? So I'm a private landlord and I rented to you under the expectation that you were going to pay me so I could... I mean, I have a whole business model built on the fact that I'm going to work my ass off to fill this place up with people who are contractually bound to pay me, that I can then, if they don't pay me, I can leverage local law to replace them with another person that will pay me. And you're saying, no. They don't have to. There's a rent moratorium and there's a mortgage moratorium. And for the next year, they don't have to pay shit.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, what happens to the underlying asset then? Oh, fuck those people. So like my answer was, government, if you want to do that, then you need to pay it for them. You're welcome to not to, to pay someone. Like, I don't like that. I don't love that solution either, you know, because I do think there's moral hazard there as well. But right. like at the end of the day, you're undermining capitalism if you're saying, to your point, that, hey, contracts are valid only when we say they are. It's yeah. like, well, wait a second. That's, that is, to your point, that is the complete foundation on which we build our capitalistic and legal society. Because who's to say what contracts I want to obey and not obey? I don't like your contracts. I'm not going to obey them. I do like your contracts. I am going to obey them. Like, which contracts become valid? And when I saw that happening, I was like, oh, this is fucked up. Because we're, I come from a mortgage servicing background, right? So as a mortgage servicer, you will blow up if people quit paying their mortgages, because the bondholder doesn't give the servicer a hall pass on paying the taxes, interest, and bond payments. And right. this happened. They went to FHFA and they said, hey, I can't remember the guy who ran it, Mark something, but they're like, hey, dude, like, you're going to blow up the entire servicing industry. Like, they're all, they have to make payments to the bondholders. By the way, if you have a pension, I'm going to say that you're like, for instance, I don't know, let's say you get a pension from, oh, let's say the military. Do you know how they make pay your fucking pension payments? Because yeah. the fucking bond gets their payment and makes a payment of interest to the bondholders who the pensions own. And now they're saying, oh, wait, no, the guy that's actually making the payment to them, you don't get to collect your payment anymore, but you still have to make your payment to the bondholder. So the buck stopped at the consumer and they started fucking the foundation below it. And yeah. that stuff is that's unhealthy and it's not okay.
And both parties are massively guilty of this. You know, I would probably blame one more than the other. But this hubris of like, oh, well, we've got the answer. You know, these couple thousand people in Washington, D.C., somehow we're so smart and we're so educated. We have the right credentials and we got elected and we have all the correct initials after our name. The hubris of like being able to say, well, we've got it all figured out. You know, we'll just not have people pay their mortgage. It's like, well, there's so much stuff downstream of that. You know, I thought it was hilarious that like, I knew people who are retired, $1 million in the bank, house is paid off, but because their Social Security plus pension plus dividends was below the whatever the number was, $85,000 threshold, they got stimulus checks. And they were like, why do I need $1,400? I know one person who even tried to find a way to like send it back, and her and her husband, they were like, we got $1,400 each several times. Had they just means tested that by either net worth or go figure, had you have to register for the stimulus check, the government would have saved billions of dollars, because there's, yeah, probably billions, at least hundreds of millions, because there's tons of people out there who didn't need it, who just got the money shipped to them, because the hubris of these politicians being like, well, you know, Bill, if you make under $85,000 a year, you must be broke and you need some government money. And they're like, no, I've got a pension. I got Social Security. My house is paid off. I got $1 million in the bank. Your $1,400 means nothing to me.
Bye. No, you just literally printed money for no reason. I know some, I'm not going to name who this person is, but I know somebody that went from a $100,000 a year boarding school in high school to a $100,000 a year private learning small liberal arts college outside of Massachusetts, who was 20 years old, whose family is like stupid wealthy, and they got a fucking stimulus check because they filed their own taxes. And I'm like, this is a person that goes to $100,000. They go to Wesleyan, right? It's like literally $100K a year for this kid to go to school. They got a job working at, probably as like a lifeguard for fun, for the hell of it. And then, just because they happen to file their own tax returns, they got a stimulus check. And I was like, dude, send that money back. Like, like, so that crazy. That is not for you. That is not for you to go fuck off with your friends. Like, that is that you are like, that is not okay. That's the opposite of ask not what you can do for yourself, ask what you can do for your country. That is the opposite of that.
What's up, TGMers? JustWorks supports small businesses with simple, seamless solutions like integrated payroll. Now, for a limited time only, try out their payroll plan for 1 month for free. As a reliable and flexible platform, JustWorks earns back time, so you can focus on running your small business with big confidence. Running a business is demanding. And look, we've all been there. You know, you're juggling countless tasks and responsibilities every single day. That's why when it comes to managing payroll, you need a solution that streamlines the process so you can focus on what really matters, growing your business. Experience the relief of streamlined payroll management with their comprehensive solution. From automated payments to accurate tax calculations and seamless withholdings, JustWorks got you covered. Plus, their expert support ensures you have the assistance every single step of the way. And here's the best part. There's no hidden fees. Designed to be flexible, JustWorks can support teams of one to as many as your small business hires, including contractors. In just 30 minutes, set up a payroll that streamlines paying your team, saves time, mitigates errors, and is a desktop and mobile friendly. You can even integrate time tracking and benefits that support running your small business with big confidence. Don't miss your chance to get 1 month free by visiting justworks.com/greatness. Secure the limited time offer and start letting JustWorks run your payroll so you don't have to. Start your free month now at justworks.com/greatness.
It's crazy, man. And I don't know what the tipping point is, because I get the thought process, right? You see this handout over here, this subsidy you don't agree with over here, and this thing being overspent on. And then all of a sudden, it's like, well, I kind of want to get mine, right? It's like there's that human instinct to be like, I'm paying into the system. I see all this stuff I disagree with. Everybody does it. A lot of people from both political persuasions or all political persuasions do it. And it's like, I keep trying to think to myself, like, where is the tipping point where we're going to have this collective awakening, or who's the leader that's going to step up and unite things and have a change in the, you know, country's psychology? And I just don't see that person on the horizon. You know, whether you were a big Bill Clinton fan or hater, or whether you're a big Reagan fan or hater, you can point to both of those people and be like, well, in the 8 years, they somehow found a way to work with an opposition Congress, and they somehow had a way of like solidifying the American vision and moving forward, you know, blowjobs and sexual preclusions in the Oval Office aside. And they did that. And I don't see anything on the horizon where there's like an awakening of the American consciousness, which scares me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think also you had a different Senate and Congress then. Reaching your hand across the aisle back then it's never been popular, but it was expected. There was compromise was part of the equation, and you didn't have the super partisan, you know, parts of the party ruling the parties, right? There was more of a moderate, you know, foundation at that point. I think we're just at a different time in the country. And, you know, if there's anything I think that anyone can agree on is that, hey, listen, if 50% of the country is happy and 50% of the country is pissed, that's not good for anybody.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't care what side you're on. Like that's just the way I see it.
Totally agree. And when you were saying that, I was reminded of something, and I wish I could source this article because I read it and it's like burnt in my brain and I can't find it. Some political commentator, maybe it was George Will or something, was talking about how in about the late 80s to early 90s, there was this change in Congress where it used to be you got elected to Congress or the Senate, you moved yourself and your whole family to Washington, D.C. You lived there, your kids went to the same school, you ate at the same restaurants, Republicans and Democrats smoked cigars together at the same place. But somewhere in about the early 90s, this started to change where congressmen and women left their families back home, would fly in to do their congressional work, you know, Monday through Wednesday or Monday through Thursday, then fly home to be home with the family and do more fundraising, constant fundraising to get reelected. And that separation of having a shared experience in Washington, D.C., where, you know, whoever, Tipper Gore and Newt Gingrich would end up having dinner together and they'd be like, yeah, I disagree with you politically, but you're a good person. I know your family, our kids go to school together. We have the same values. This political commentator in this article was tracking the division in the country from that point to where we are now, where it's like basically no politician domiciles with their entire family in Washington, D.C., except for the president and the vice president, and how this divide of like shared experience and everybody going back to their super partisan base to do fundraising every single week has just destroyed the like the social glue that used to hold those people together and have them reach across the aisle. And that to me was a really compelling argument, because like if you and I disagree violently about politics and we never break bread together and be like, oh, he likes pink and I like red, but that doesn't mean we're evil. It just means like he values pink and I value red. But you know what? We both want to raise our kids in a great America. You know, that disappears. All of a sudden, all I see is your ugly hot pink and all you see is my ugly bright red, and we hate each other. And it's just, it's silly.
Yeah. And it goes back to this simple idea that this comes down to, you know, relationship, right? And people that have relationships with each other, you know, even if they don't agree, then at least there's a mutual respect around where they're coming from, right? So because they understand each other's values, right? And when we understand each other's values, then we can have empathy for where we're coming from, right?
Right.
And right now, you know, we're in a place where there is a, well, first of all, people are living inside their homes more or less because of this whole COVID pandemic. People are on social media, which I think is really, you know, as connecting as it has been for you and for me,
right.
is probably the opposite for most people. Most people, it is dividing, and it pushes people into their own little echo chambers where they start to, you know, create really like villainize people that don't agree with them. I think I know what the answer is. I don't like the solution I'm landing on.
Let's go for it. What do you think the solution is?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that people generally don't take action unless the pain is so bad that they are forced to take action.
Yeah.
So the conclusion I came to is that the only thing that's going to probably solve this is pain.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that pain is or what degree of that pain is. And you and I have a mutual friend, Tucker Max, that just has some very strong beliefs on what that pain could be.
But
if you read like Changing World Order by Ray Dalio, or you've read Howell's book, The Fourth Turning, you know, we're at a part in these 80-year, 100-year cycles where, you know, economics has driven, you know, disparate, you know, camps to form. And you have a lot of the rich are getting richer than ever before. The middle class is being dissolved. And you have an economic underpinning that is not healthy for our nation. And around this part of the cycle, there's a lot of, you know, again, this is if you're looking at it historically, there's a lot of disagreement, a lot of division, and a lot of volatility politically, culturally, socially. And so, you know, I think that to your point earlier, as you don't see on the horizon a great leader, I do think leadership is the answer. That's the anecdote to this. Is really, really strong leadership. And my hopes are that that comes from somewhere. I don't see it either at this point, but, you know, it can come out of nowhere. You know,
yeah.
Leadership is not concrete. It's something that can come from out of nowhere if you get the right person and the right mindset and they can build a following. But I unfortunately think it's going to be one of two camps. One is we're going to have this great leader that appears that can unite everybody, but I think it's going to come through pain. I think there's going to be some event that is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and out of that will be born it'll force change to happen that needs to happen that we're not willing to do right now, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know what it sounds like to me that you're describing, and I can always go back to a movie reference because I'm a movie nutbag, and this was one of my favorite movies from my childhood, is West Side Story. Like, West Side Story is this growing tension of like two groups of generally good people with some hoodlum tendencies who are like escalating. And at the end of the movie, it's like, oh, shit got real and somebody got dead. And I really feel that's where we're at. Whether it's the protest in Portland or the riot at the Capitol, whatever, it's like there's this low level tension that's building and sometimes somebody gets dead. But it does feel like there's going to have to be some massive pain in the country's psyche to get better. And the thing that's hard for me, and I don't know if you're experiencing the same thing, it's almost like, was the beginning of War and Peace. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It's like my wife and I are trying to give back because we have a lot of friends and family that are in the, you know, lower socioeconomic tier who have had a lot of pain the last year. But, you know, I can tell you kind of selfishly and embarrassingly, the last 2 years for our family has been like the best ever, you know, great years in the mortgage business financially. The assets that we own are through the roof because if you have assets, you're crushing it right now. Housing, gold, stock market, whatever, it doesn't matter. You know, we've kind of found our tribe of jujitsu people that said, screw it at the very beginning. We're going to work out together no matter what and stay healthy. So it's like, I've lost weight. You know, wealth is up. Business is going well. More quality time working from home with my family than ever before. So I feel like for us, it's the best of times, but I don't have to look that far, you know, from friends or family, be like, oh, there's some real struggle out there. And we try to do what we can and give back in the ways that we feel that's appropriate. But it's a really weird time where you see like a huge cross section of people struggling just to make ends meet. And then you're like, oh, we created more millionaires, billionaires, and more, you know, paper money in the stock market in the last 2 years than ever in the history of America. That feels kind of weird. I mean, it's a really precarious time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you know, it's funny. I was like, I don't know if we're going to talk politics. And fucking here we are, man. Like,
God, here we are.
You're early in that. You're like, yeah. If any of my real estate people hear me talking, it's like they're going to pull the plug. It's like, I don't know, man. I have a tough time. You know, I don't like to talk politics because it's polarizing, right?
Right.
But you and I are. It's funny. We took this Pew assessment, right? And you were like the disgruntled. What was yours? Just like the dispassionate or
dispassionate observer or something like that.
Yeah. It was like there is no home for Scott Groves, and mine was like the barely right wing.
Right. You're a liberal right winger. It was like, yeah, you and I are politically homeless, like so many other people, and. You know, maybe that pain that we've been talking about the last 10 minutes, which what a downer of an episode, by the way. Sorry to anybody watching.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that pain will create a legitimate third party or something that we can't even foresee on the horizon that'll just make the country so much better. Because I'm not like a total naysayer. I'm not like, oh, China's going to take us over. China's got all kinds of their own political problems and whatnot. I think we're still living in an exceptional country. That's an amazing place to live with a ton of opportunity. You just got to go out and find a way to get it. You know, just a little worried, but so much of this is just like you can control your own fate, right? You can control your friend circle. You can control what you take in on Facebook. You can control how much you lead, generate, and make money and grow your business. Like there is still a lot of self-control that we have over our own direction. We just got to turn off social media once in a while and not get sucked into the echo chambers and the vacuum.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, you have business life and you have the family life, but let's move over into this project that you've had for a while that with, you know, On the Edge podcast. So I know that that's a big thing for you. Like I think the listeners might be interested in learning more about it. Like how did that come to be? How did you guys start the podcast?
Yeah. So funny story. I smoke a lot of cigars to my wife's chagrin. She doesn't really like it. It's the one habit I have that she wishes I would get rid of. I smoke a lot of cigars and, you know, an average large, long, somewhat expensive cigar would take about 2 hours to smoke. So I found myself at these cigar lounges and kind of like that TV show Cheers, you can walk into any cigar lounge in America and find pretty much the same cast of characters. It's hilarious how like just uniformed it is. I've smoked cigars all over the country and it's like any cigar lounge, it's basically the same cast of characters. So this one night I'm talking to this guy who I can't remember his name, but he did something like, ran global technology for some like Fortune 100 company, a guy that I would never, ever, ever have access to unless we happened to be at the same lounge smoking cigars. And we had like this 2 hour conversation on politics and business and how Disney is putting RFID chips in the bracelet so that they can better control flow of personnel so that they can better get more people on rides and maximize profit. It was just this amazing business conversation that led to politics, that led to a funny story about him meeting Justice Scalia. And it was just like, we got done with the conversation. And I'm like, Jesus, why was that conversation not recorded for other people to hear? Or as like a great learning tool for my 19-year-old son, which is a whole different story. I didn't even know he existed until he was 15. We're playing a lot of catch up. He's an awesome kid. And I'm like, I'm having so many awesome 2 hour long form conversations. And would I love to be Joe Rogan one day? Yeah, that'd be awesome. But there's only one Joe Rogan. But I'm like, I'm just coming across super cool people who I'm having a cigar with. Why not put on some headphones and hit record and go from there? So that turned into On the Edge podcast. Inevitably, because of the mortgage business, I end up having a lot of interesting conversations with people about, you know, the way they make their money and their opinion on finances and their opinion about the economy going forward. And it's not appropriate for me to talk about those conversations for fiduciary responsibilities due to the fact that I'm doing their home loan. But if I can get them to come on the podcast and talk about it, well, now it's free game and it's out there in the public atmosphere. So that kind of started the project during the pandemic. My buddy, Chris, who's like a great marketing guy, he kind of needed a side gig. So I'm like, this is kind of my version of charity to Chris to keep the podcast going so he can stay and work and edit it. And it's weird. Like sometimes our content will get 4 views and I'll feel like a loser. And sometimes it'll get a couple thousand views and I can't believe that many people wanted to hear us talk. So yeah, it's just a work in progress. And maybe one day I'll write a book that takes off and then people will have a catalog of 200 back episodes to go listen to on my thought process and my own kind of rants. And, you know, sometimes it's just talking through me thinking about my own political and social and economic beliefs, which are constantly a work in progress. So that's it, man. Some people love it. Some people hate it. And it's out there for people to digest and see what they're interested in.
Have you ever, I kind of feel the same way with this show. I mean, this show is just about people kind of living their best lives to create something cool. And I mean, and your story is unique, right? Like most people in the mortgage business don't have a podcast and write a book and do coaching and are as active as you are, right? Like you're actually more of a anomaly for the greatness machine than most people. Other people, like my last episode I did was my friend Chris Pronger, who's the one of the top. He's an NHL Hall of Famer, right? That's more like when you think of like a typical greatness story. That's like how the fuck do you become top 100 NHL player of all time?
Right.
You're born with some God-given gifts and you go and get after it, right? But in his story, we just talked about hockey the whole time. You know, I think, again, when you're meeting folks like Scott, where it's like, yeah, you're in the mortgage space, but that's probably the least interesting part of your life. You know, like, I mean, although the mortgage space is definitely like an interesting space, it's more like there's more access to that. A lot of people can get into the mortgage space.
Yeah.
But starting a podcast and writing a book, it's like, hey, listen, I've done both those. They're both a pain in the ass to get off the ground.
Right.
And then to keep them off the ground is even harder. You know, I mean, anyone can start a podcast and then not do anything with it and not keep it going. But for you, like when you look at like the podcast, I love the story, the fact that the reason you've done it is it was like a way to capture kind of these intimate conversations you're having in the cigar bar. You know, when you look at the future of On the Edge podcast or what you would like to do with it, if you could have it your way, what would you do?
You know, I'd like to talk to more and more educated, interesting people that have a strong view on politics or economics. Like, he's unfortunately in the twilight of his life, but somebody like Thomas Sowell, who wrote amazing books on economics, I'd love to talk to somebody at that level and just like ask them basic economic questions and how that, you know, kind of interplays with like all the craziness we see now. You know, I think your book actually helped me because I actually read your book, unlike most people that go on shows. I've read your book cover to cover. One of the things that your book helped me solidify in my mind that I had kind of figured out over like 5 years is that my number one core value is variety. You know, I thought growing up and then even in my 20s, I wanted to be the NHL hockey player who like picked one thing and I was the best at it. And that was my sole focus of life. And then in my 30s, I started realizing that like, no, there's something else there. And at the time, I wasn't calling it a core value. I didn't even know the core value was variety. But, you know, the core value is variety. And to be honest, it used to show up in other ways, like dating and things like that. Now I'm happily married and my wife's amazing, so I can't change around the variety of people that I date. So I've got to do it with businesses and opportunities, because your book helped me solidify that like my core value is variety. So if the podcast could become something where like I'm getting a hit of variety every time we film an episode and like learning something new and expanding my mind, to me, that's like a huge win. And hopefully there's enough people that also their core value is variety.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that is, I could totally see that with you. If you're to, you know, look out 10 years in the future right now, you're on the verge of 43, going from 43 to 53. What would you like to tell like the 53-year-old version of Scott Groves to make sure that he does it right over the next 10 years?
I would tell myself to stay the course on keeping expenses low and really diving in the next 10 years of diverting as much money as possible to passive income. Because I want to get to the point actually before 53. I want to get to the point at like 50 where, you know, my oldest son will be 26, 27, hopefully getting married, maybe having kids. My, 5 and 3 year old will be right in that age where I'll want to coach high school wrestling, or I'll want to be able to pick them up at the end of the day and like just do cool stuff because time is going to be limited with them before they leave for college. Like, you know, in the next couple of years, I really want to make sure all of the effort that went into focused on like how to make money really goes into focusing on how to preserve it and have money make money. Because passive income, like if I get to the point where the girls that run the mortgage team could get 90% of the revenue and do 90% of the work, and I could just do like podcasts, jujitsu, smoke cigars, spend quality time with my kids in the next, you know, 5 to 7 years where that's like the full-time plan, I'll consider my life a success. That's kind of what I'm looking for, man.
Yeah. You know, Justin Donald. There you go.
Yeah. I picked his brain a lot.
Yeah. Like, just go hang out with Justin.
I got exposed to him. I got exposed to him through Front Row Dads, which was amazing, kind of just stroke of genius. And we've made a couple investments with his people that I'm pretty excited about. So yeah, it's just like, you know, I had a great conversation with a friend of mine, Adam Stock, who's a financial planner, also from Front Row Dads. And, you know, it's just a spreadsheet. He's like, here's the amount of money you got to peel off every 3 to 4 months to get to this point by your 50, by the time you're 50. And I'm going to hold you accountable to not allowing expenses to go up as more passive income is coming through, because you can get to this number pretty quickly. And, you know, I would never want to be retired. Like, I would love to do just more podcasts, maybe mentor more people in the mortgage space. But yeah, that's the real goal. I don't want to be absentee in my children's teenage years just because they're older and they're on an iPhone.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to make sure they don't get the iPhones till they're 13 or 14.
Yeah. Or like 23, maybe.
Or 50.
Yeah. 50. Yeah. So bugs only.
So look, man, we're coming towards the end of the show, but where can people connect with you and find you? Obviously there's all sorts of things that can get you on the podcast for folks that want to get coached, and I guess we didn't even talk much about the coaching, but maybe spend a few minutes on the coaching and then
Coaching is coaching, man. It's like, most adults don't need to learn new things. They just need to be reminded of the things they already know. I've got a sign here right above my desk that says, seek not what's new, but rather what's true. And I stole that from our mutual friend, John Vroman, because it's true, man. Like, most coaching problems are just a consistent reminder and accountability of the stuff you already know you need to be doing. Look, if you own a business, you're fully commissioned, or you sell a product, spoiler alert, lead generation probably has to be part of your daily activities, right? And right. So we're constantly just teaching that and coaching that. And yeah, Facebook's probably the easiest thing. I'm Scott Groves, not the guy who's in Australia who wants to be Tony Robbins and is a mindset motivational coach. It makes me so mad because he owns everything scottgroves.com. Oh, and he has like 7 followers. It makes me so bitter. So find Scott Groves, the one that's in Los Angeles and Las Vegas. We're back and forth between the two cities a lot. And yeah, that's the easiest way to reach out to me. I can help with mortgages. I'm an intellectual philanthropist. Anybody wants to talk about mortgages, lead generation, marketing, coaching, podcasting, I don't care. I'll give anybody any amount of information for free. So
what's the website that's best to find you at?
I don't know. Just email me, Scott@ScottGrovesTeam. There's too much stuff out there. Scott@ScottGrovesTeam and Scott Groves on Facebook. I don't have a branded website because that dude in Australia owns
fucking everything. Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
As I tell John Roman's like, what's your favorite saying? I'm like, fuck that guy. Yeah. Fuck you, Scott Groves in Australia. You know, like you can't steal my boy's thunder.
I'm sure he's a nice guy. I've emailed him a bunch of times trying to buy his handle and buy his website, and he never responds. So yeah. I'm sure.
In his defense, I'd tell you to fuck off, and I would.
Yeah, of course.
No, I'd be like, yeah, right. I'm like, change your name, buddy.
That'd be a good one.
Anastasia Groves.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, man, look, you guys. Scott@ScottGrovesTeam.com. Is that right?
Yep. Scott@ScottGrovesTeam.com. Pretty easy.
You guys check out Scott Groves there. You can check him out on the Edge podcast, where you can hear him banter like over cigars and politics and the changing world order.
Yeah.
And even more importantly than that, lead generate the book. We got to bring you in for the Scale Map Method Bootcamp to talk about lead gen.
I love it, man. I'm super passionate about it. And again, it's really just habits. You know, that doesn't matter what your thing is, organic, paid, phone calls, Facebook. Like, it doesn't matter. Whatever it is, it has to become a daily process.
Well, you guys, you heard it here. My man, Scott Groves, changing the world, being the polymath that he is. I'm so pumped to get to know you over the last 24 months. And I'm super pumped for the next 24 months of us getting to change the world together, my friend.
Thanks, man. I'll be in Austin soon, maybe looking at a house out there in Dripping Springs where all the cool kids are moving. So I'll let you know when I'm in town.
I can't wait for it. Scott, thank you so much, brother. So much gratitude having you on the show. Everyone, we'll talk to you guys soon. Peace out. We love you.
You are listening to The Greatness Machine, and that's a wrap for today. Listen, if you love what you heard, subscribe to the show on whatever podcast platform that you're tuning in on so that you don't miss any of our future episodes. We have tons of great people coming on, and we're stoked to have you here to enjoy it with us. Leave us a review. Tell us what you love most about this particular episode. We love getting the reviews. We love to see what you guys love most. And if this particular episode, you know, made you think of someone who's leveling up in their business and in their life, Print screen, share it with them. Leaders are the best givers, and after all, we're all here to support and grow with each other. And in case you want to see some of the fun behind-the-scenes shots or some of the things that we're doing, I'm actually writing about this in my weekly newsletter. Go to www.therealdarius.com and subscribe to my newsletter. We're talking about fun things like business and life and mindfulness and cryptocurrencies and, gosh, I don't even know, everything and anything. But it's tons of fun stuff I write about. I try to get it out on a weekly basis. You can subscribe at www.therealdarius.com. And with that said, look, thank you guys so much. Appreciate you. I love you. Peace. We're out of here. See you guys on the next one.
Hey there. What's up, everybody? Darius here, and I'm here to tell you about my main man, Robert Glazer, and his amazing show, The Elevate Podcast. Robert is a buddy of mine, and his Elevate Podcast is second to none. So The Elevate Podcast, what is it? It's a conversational show where Robert sits down with world-class CEOs, New York Times best-selling authors, and the best thought leaders and performers in their fields. You're going to hear stories about triumph, failure, resilience, more importantly, all the learnings along the way. So some of his guests include James Clear from Atomic Habits, Angela Duckworth from Grit, Susan Cain, author of Quiet, Morning Brew founder and CEO Alex Lieberman, and hundreds more. Every episode shares valuable insights in how to expand your capabilities as a leader and align your life and work to your most important principles. Robert's goal is that you're going to leave each episode inspired and with plenty of next steps that you can put into practice, into your life. And look, if you're looking to elevate your life, your leadership, and your business, Elevate is the show for you. It's like I always say, we as podcast listeners, we listen to 6 shows, not just mine, but Bob should be one of yours. Subscribe to the Elevate Podcast today on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Check it out.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.